This Father's Day, celebrate the one who's always been your rock with the gift of comfort from Minky Couture. Whether he's relaxing after a long day, watching the game, or sneaking in that well-earned nap, nothing says thank you like the luxury of a Minky blanket. Soft, stylish, strong, just like Dad. Visit MinkyCouture.com or stop by a store near you and give Dad the comfort he truly deserves. Minky Couture, because even heroes need to rest.
Hi, I'm Bunny Guinness, and this is my podcast, Bunny in the Garden, with someone special. Someone who is well known for something other than their green fingers, but who is also a mustard-keen gardener. I'll discover them through their garden, why, how, and when they garden, the best tips they've learnt, and their gardening style and approach. I'm happy to be in the garden of David Austin Jr., who has probably done more for promoting, growing and developing English roses alongside his late father, also David Austin, than anyone. Pretty much everyone loves their roses. Even David Beckham plants them. By breeding modern traits such as repeat flowering and disease resistance into beautiful old-fashioned roses, they have ensured that roses continue to be many people's favourite. They are a stunning addition to modern and traditional gardens and can be used in many ways, in wilder areas, formal gardens, in many climates and many conditions. So, David, it's lovely to be here in this lovely little hut overlooking your beautiful garden. Really lovely. So your father, the late David Austin, devoted much of his long life to breeding roses, and he started his nursery in 69. Was that right?
69, 70, but he did have a go at it 3 years before, maybe yes. 4 years before, but didn't succeed with his first attempt.
Right. And the logo for your rose nursery is a picture of the Bowling Green. That's a beautiful Queen Anne house where you were brought up.
That's right, yeah. I lived there from birth till the age of about 11. And the house is a Queen Anne house, I think you've just mentioned, is the logo for the company. And my mother painted or drew that original drawing. So it's still there with us.
Ah, I didn't realise that Pat, your mum, did that.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, great.
Originally, it was an oval shape with flowers in an oval shape, but it needed to be rounded off because the marketing people thought it was slightly too big. But it still is essentially my mother's work.
Oh, lovely. And it originally belonged to Clara Austin, who was your and my great grandmother, and she was a very keen gardener, wasn't she?
Do you know, I didn't know that.
Well, David, I remember David, I had a chat to David, I think I interviewed him for the Telegraph or something, and he said he used to trot up the road age five, because he didn't live there, did he? It was his grandmother's house, and he had a small veg and flower patch there, which he helped with the gardener. And the gardener was the one that gave him some seeds and got him gardening, he said. But Clara was keen to install a commercial element, and she took the produce that he grew to Old Brighton to sell. That was his story.
That's the story. Bit of the story I do know about his almost in entrepreneurship came from that starting point of selling the cabbages or the lettuce.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. But I didn't realise that. Obviously, it makes sense now because they lived in a house called The Nest, which is actually on the farm.
Yes.
About 500 yards from the house where Clara would have been living. Yeah. So they were obviously very close. And I've always wondered how my father got so into gardening, because they must have moved at some point to All Brighton in Shrewsbury, where he actually designed the garden there as a young man.
Yeah.
So it may be that Clara was the one that actually got him into gardening, which I didn't really fully appreciate, but could well be the case.
And he did say, I'm sure he said it was the gardener that gave him the seeds to encourage him. And then he got a plot there and he did it there. And I just thought it was such a lovely story.
Yeah,
so
great.
That gardener.
Yeah, good
the
job.
Responsible
they did
man
a good job.
Yeah, exactly. But what are your childhood memories of that garden?
Well, what I always say about the Bowling Green is that I had no idea I was interested in gardening. I was into football and motorbikes and stuff like that. But when I started gardening at the age of sort of 21, 22, when I got my first house, I really took to it. And I could then think back to the garden. I can remember every plant in every position in that garden. I can remember the echinops, I can remember the lily of the valley, I can remember the rubifolia, I can remember the iris. I can actually picture every single plant in that garden. I bet most kids, it wouldn't even registered with them. But it,
and
obviously,
who would have told you their names?
I think.
Or did you not know their names?
I probably learned them subsequently, yeah, but they all hit the begonias, another one. You know, they were all there. In, and it's interesting. Subconsciously, but also it's how you get to know a garden over a period of time. I think perhaps about 4 or 5 years is what takes you to get really into what you're doing. So, yeah, it's stuck in my mind.
It stuck in my mind a lot because we didn't come and see you that often, did we? But I remember your mum was a great sculptress, and I remember at one point there was a huge sort of plastic sheeting enclosure and she was sculpting bears for Susan Hampshire. And she'd be frenetically chipping away at this life-size bear. They're extraordinary hunks of stone. And I remember her saying, oh, the first hunk of stone came and it had a snag in it or something. So she had to send it back and get another one. And then she did a lovely little sort of gargoyle-y thing and built this rill. With this, the water came out of this gargoyle snake's
right.
mouth, didn't
yeah.
she?
Yeah.
It was all slightly chaotic, wasn't it, your mum's garden? Because your father was doing his roses on the nursery in a very much more organised way, apple pie order, and your mother was much more sort of creative, how should we put it, bohemian almost.
Bohemian,
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean,
driving around in her old red Land Rover.
Yeah.
It was legendary.
Well, she rewilded before rewilding was fashionable. I mean, yes. We used to open for the National Garden Scheme and most people loved it, but quite a few used to come along. It's very weedy, your garden, you know. So, and it was her area, a bit like we may talk about this garden here, how we have our areas. And I think it frustrated my father. I think he would have liked to have given a little bit more order to it. And it is a little bit of sadness. I say, when she passed away, he got the house garden back and he totally transformed it. And it is now in apple pie order. And it is fantastic. My mother's garden was fantastic, but yeah, much more traditional garden, my father. So
That was interesting. I remember that, seeing it for the first time after she passed away, sadly, and he had his way with it.
He did.
And it was like he'd waited for 30-odd years she had control of it. And it always fascinates me, this thing with couples and gardens, because quite often they like very different styles.
Absolutely.
And you do get the odd one or two that do it in harmony, but it's actually quite rare.
It is. Well, the classic was one of my mother's favourite trees is a monkey puzzle tree. And we had the most amazing monkey puzzle tree, but it was in the wrong place. And my dad, soon as she got, chopped it down, I couldn't believe he'd chopped this tree. And actually, my next tree for this garden is going to be a monkey puzzle tree in her memory, because we need to bring it back.
They are Marmite. I have to say, so many questions on problem monkey puzzle trees, because normally they're planted within 3 feet of a small house.
Yeah.
You know, and then 80 years on,
they get quite large, don't they?
Very large indeed. But no, it was fascinating hearing about your father and how, when I chatted to him, how he actually got into it all. Because he was great friends with James Baker. Did you know James Baker was his father, Charles Austin?
Yeah, that was the big story, wasn't it? James Baker got to know a guy called Russell, who bred the lupins.
Russell Lupins.
And they had been, to that point, so I'm told, only blue, and he'd bred all these different coloured lupins. And obviously James Baker, being a successful entrepreneur and nurseryman, realised what the guy had got. But he was a very reclusive character and he didn't want to put them on the market. So James Baker worked away on him and persuaded him that he would introduce these lupins to the market. And at a nursery, it's called Bonningale Nursery, which is not far from the nursery. And my father can remember queues and queues of traffic because it created this amazing sensation.
Yeah.
And that was part of his inspiration. Subconsciously or consciously, he realised what you could actually get out of doing something with plants, you know.
Yeah, breeding.
Breeding new varieties, yeah.
And at school, he was good, wasn't he? He said he was, you know, because he was hugely dyslexic, which I think a lot of us lot are, whether there are his siblings or I'm not sure. But he was very good at botany and genetics at school. And maybe that stemmed from this interest. I don't know. But that's what he told me.
That's an interesting one.
I
don't think he would have done genetics. He would have done Mendelssohn's peas,
yes,
probably.
And the basics. In biology, A-level
That remains an interesting area.
Yeah. And then he started to breed a perennial wheat, which I thought was interesting. And that was a good idea, but he just didn't have the facilities to do it.
I think it's a brilliant idea. Yeah. Still seems one that makes a lot of sense to me, you know. Where the seed companies realise if you've got a perennial wheat, you don't sell next year's seed.
Yeah.
So it's obvious that no traditional or commercial breed is going to do it because it's going to finish their livelihood.
I hadn't thought of that. So obvious you've got a commercial brain on you. Yes. So, and then at 18, which is incredibly young, he bought some of the popular hybrid tea roses from Harry Wheatcroft and some old roses from George Bunyard, and who had bought them back, hadn't he, the old varieties, since they sort of lost popularity in the late 19th century. And then he thought if he hybridised the two, he could have the prolific blooms of one and the beauty and charm of the other.
Absolutely.
And that was the germ of the idea. And were you aware of that when he was doing it, when he started it?
I think it's so much part of the DNA of what we do, and it is still the essence of what we do today. You know, it's that look of the old-fashioned rose, which is much more charming, much more beautiful, much softer, got the amazing fragrance. But they don't repeat flower, most of them. Although, and then crossing them with the wider colour range of the hybrid tea and the repeat flowering to get the best of both worlds. Very simple idea, but brilliant. You know, a great idea, and still what we do today.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And as you said before, he said the first lot he bred and all the seedlings damped off some fungal thing or whatever. So it wasn't an overnight success. But I always remember him saying that when he came to Chelsea, you know, it was like a slow tap dripping, you know, the washer gets worse and worse and the momentum really built up. And then when he came to Chelsea for the first time in 69, Jack Harkness said to him, and he was standing by the entrance, and he says, "If anyone else asks me where those Chaucer roses are, I'll scream." Because everybody was talking about them.
I've just got to correct you here, Bunny.
Yes.
The first Chelsea was 1982. I know, because I was there.
Oh, okay. Right. Sorry, yes.
And the story about screaming was, I think, the next year, 83, when we launched Mary Rose and Madame Mary Rose and Heritage, and everybody was looking for these roses. And I don't think it was Jack Harkness. It may have been Jack Harkness, but we certainly were irritating a few of the existing rose industry. But even then, it was still a tiny company. I mean, our stand was a cabbage patch. It was tiny. And he'd been going, as you say, since 69, 70. So we're talking 12 years on. And what you have to remember, in 1970, when he started, he had six repeat flowering varieties. Six. Yeah. That's all we had. We have now introduced over 250 varieties. And probably by 82, we might have had about 40 or 50 varieties. But they were the early results of his work. And the work has gone on to improve the quality, so there's been so much more work done to improve where we're at that point.
Yeah, but Mary Rose was an early one, and that won Rose of the Year and is still
awards haven't been our strong point, to be quite honest, but
the
consumers, absolutely, the customers, the gardeners, they absolutely love what we do. And Mary Rose, when it was introduced, was so different to anything else that anybody could buy. And it was a great repeat flower, and it just caught the public's imagination, and it also caught the the Rosewell's imagination. So we were getting, in the early 80s, we were getting all the more interesting Rose people who really loved roses, tend to be the less commercial people who could see what he was doing. So people like Jensen in Germany, Teschner in South Africa, they could see what my father was doing, and they said, well, can we sell these roses for you, you know? So we started that licensing side of the business.
Yes.
And started to spread David Austin roses across the world. They just went like crazy, the whole of the industry, not the mainstream industry. And then the mainstream industry started to think, oh blimey, there's something going on here, we need to take an interest in this. So people like the biggest in America, Jackson and Perkins, suddenly started knocking on our door saying, can we do these roses? Because they could see that they were commercially viable as well, not only popular but viable. So
I remember once I went to you and you had just launched in Germany, I don't know when that was, and that you said, or David said, your fax was just jammed because you just put an advert somewhere in Germany and it just jammed with orders. It just could not cope.
Yeah, yeah. There's been some great moments like that.
Yeah.
The one that sticks in my mind is when we did the very first full-page Telegraph advert. That was probably early 90s, and it was like, oh my God, it was just the reaction was phenomenal. I mean, yeah. With a post bag was like, you know, piles of posts coming in those days.
Wow.
So we knew we were onto something.
God, well done. And now, obviously, I mean, how many people do you employ breeding? It used to, when I last, there was about 20 people in the breeding houses.
It's about the same. Yeah. About the same, yeah.
And then total employees would be?
About, well over 200.
Wow.
In three countries, Japan and America being the two other countries that we have a base in.
Mm. And your father always said that you had a very good eye for a rose. So is this something, because you wandered around the garden with him from the age of a grasshopper, size of a grasshopper, and you just looked at them, or you just think it's just in your DNA?
It's in our DNA. Yeah. I had, as I said, growing up, I had literally no, except for working there to earn money to buy a motorbike when I was 14 and 15. So when I was 14, I was the head woodcutter. You know, we operated from what is now an old garage, you know, with a team of four or five people. I'd wander up the field, cut the wood, mark the catalogue. So I was.
When you say cut the wood, so that's the
wood.
Cuttings to go onto,
yeah.
The grafting onto the rootstocks.
Exactly that. Exactly. The commercial growing of the rose.
Yeah.
And
so those will be little bits of green wood.
Yep.
And they'll be about 100 mil, 4 inches long, something like that.
The wood you cut will be 30 centimetres.
Oh, then you cut it down.
And then you have about four or five buds on each piece of wood.
Yes.
And the grafter would take the bud where the leaf joins the stem. They take that bud and they T-bud it onto a rootstock in the field.
Right.
So that whole process is, you know, quite very labour intensive and very hard work, but I was in it right from the beginning
as a woodcutter.
What you try to avoid was being the patcher, and the patcher was the guy who went behind the budder. So the budder was the kind of the king, and they could do sometimes 5,000 grafts a day, like
bending down
with their backs bent all day long, and you had to keep up with them putting these rubber ties to hold the bud in place. That was torture. It was mind-numbing. It was horrible. It
bending.
Was such hard work. Mm. So anything to get out of patching. So wood cutting, by comparison, was a joy. So I loved that.
And you got your motorbike, your Harley-Davidson.
I got my moped and then my motorbike. So I was happy.
Right. But interestingly, when you all left school, the three of you, Jim and Claire, none of you originally went into horticulture, did you? You went into business. And I always remember that you were business oriented. You used to read the Financial Times, age about 12, 13.
Bit older.
40.
I think my mother had some shares in her company. Her parents' company were bookbinders in Wolverhampton.
Yes.
And also our grandparents had a share portfolio. you probably won't remember this. And I remember looking at them and starting to think that this is interesting. How does this all work? And I'd always, we come from a very entrepreneurial family.
Yes.
It's, you know, as well as gardening, I think entrepreneurship is very strong in our genes. So the two go together. And my father, yes, he was an amazing breeder and that was his passion, but he was also very commercial and he understood how to communicate with the public, and his catalogues were brilliant, and people would say, I'd take your catalogue to bed with me. I mean, that was said so many times because you could feel his passion from how he wrote about the roses. It was totally, you know, in his soul, he was totally genuine and a real communicator. Whereas, no disrespect, but if you're a commercial company, you've got a commercial writer writing about a product, it's not quite the same, you know. So it's all about the passion.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. But and also, I think in Britain, our nurseries tend to be run by people who have a passion and love plants, but they're not necessarily business people. And if you go to Holland, it's so different, isn't it? You know, you have one nursery producing just one line.
Yeah.
Somebody, another firm markets it. Another firm does this.
Yes.
They are streamlined. They're superb businessmen and they'll flog anything to anyone.
They will, but they lack true passion.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you can combine the two, you've got a brilliant combination.
Well, I thought that's what happened. So you when you joined the firm, so initially you went into jewellery, like Monty Don, same time as Monty Don?
Well, I actually worked at the reason I was going to train to be an accountant. Not because I wanted to be an accountant, but because I thought it was a great way of learning about other businesses. I had a strategy, and that's another thing. My father had a strategy. I've always had a strategy. Is really where you're going to go, what you're trying to do. It's true in lots of parts of life. But then the thought of doing the exams and my father going, come and work for me, come and work for me, come and work for me. I thought, I'll go on then. I'll go and work for you then. So for 3 years, when the company was tiny, I helped out. It was, I'm sorry to say, very boring. It wasn't enough to stimulate me. And I got loads of energy and I wanted to get on. And my first wife was in the jewellery business. And that, frankly, had more opportunity at that time, was more exciting than working in the rose business. But when I left him, I can remember sitting in the what is now the dining room at the Bowling Green, standing against a storage radiator. I said, this is going to be massive one day. I can feel it. This is going to be big. But it just wasn't going fast enough at that time for me. It needed more time to get a little bit more going. So I spent 8 years in the jewellery business. And that was the time that the rose business needed, just to get a little bit more established. So that early 90s period, we were really just, that's when the big companies like Jackson and Perkins were taking an interest. So there was I came from a tiny business in a business that had in back into a business had was right on the cusp and ready to go. So I just traveled all over the world, Australia, New Zealand, America, Canada, all over Europe, talking to rose growers who wanted to grow our roses. And that licensing to all these growers funded the development of the whole business. I also then started on the wholesale side of the business, which is another obvious thing to do. And over the next 5 or 6 years, we ended up in all the garden centres across the UK, you know. So, and the garden centres are really important, have been really important to the development of our company, because everybody's walking in seeing our name. You know, every gardener goes into any serious gardener goes into a garden centre and there'll be a section of David Austin roses. And so it all started to snowball. It was an incredibly exciting time.
Yeah. So really, you know, working in another business like a jewelry business, I mean, all businesses, they have lots of things in common, and you are more business, you are very business savvy, aren't you? So you added the element that perhaps your father could never have done. So it was a brilliant combination.
It was a great, and also, you know, a lot of breeders just breed roses, you know. You know, Philip Harkness now, great breeder, just breeds roses, you know. Running a business and being a breeder, You know, it's a full time. If you want to be a successful breeder, if you want to go into become, you know, do a good job in plant breeding, don't do anything else. Mm. You know, you have to dedicate yourself. So somebody then has to commercialize it. Well, we had the perfect partnership where I could commercialize everything for him. Mm. But also what was it's been great is I am a gardener as well. So, I mean, for the last like 10 years or so, I've walked all the new varieties before introduction. I mean, heavily involved in the breeding side of the business. And because at the end of the day, it's about introducing amazing roses. You know, what we're trying to do is give great garden plants to excite gardeners and make your garden look more beautiful. So if you don't focus on that, if you don't keep that as your most important thing, you can forget the commercial stuff. Mm. You know, you've got to give the gardener something special. And I think, you know, we do trials of all roses, and a lot of the modern hybrid teas and floribundas, I'm sorry to say, they ain't very good. I mean, you might think I'm biased, but genuinely, if they were good, I would say so. But the rose breeders is a bit controversial, a bit outspoken, but I don't think they're doing a good enough job, you know.
Well, I noticed that you said with Emma Bridgewater, your recent one that you launched at Chelsea this year, you did 10 years trials.
10 years. It's
and normally it would have been 8.
It was just do a little bit about the introduction process. You get to a point, say in year 8, you need another 2 years before you can put it on the market. So it was 8 plus 2. So we say 10 years to get to the market. It's now 10 plus 2. Right. It's 12 years. Because the process of really evaluating a rose, these are shrub roses. They're not hybrid teas, which you cut back to the ground and they grow up and they have to perform first year. Ours take 4 years to reach maturity, like many, many shrubs. You know, they don't just suddenly give you everything. You have to wait for them to grow and form, get their roots down, establish themselves. And at that point, you can, over that period, you can really see how good they are. And the thing that we really look at a lot is how well they do in the second flowering during the autumn period, when a lot of roses have done well on the first flowering will look terrible by the second flowering.
They lose steam. They don't have enough.
They don't. Yeah, don't have enough resistance. Don't have enough vigor. Whatever it is, they just they need. You need to. That's what we do. We make sure that the rose is really robust, as well as beautiful, as well as scented, as well as a nice shape. They've got to perform.
Yeah.
And it's repeat flowering for any shrub is quite hard work. So, you know, you've got to really work at the breeding to make sure you can deliver that. So we will literally start with 60,000 seedlings, everyone different. And the first flowering in the bench, 5,000 will go out in the field.
You'll select the best. That's
just on the flower. That's just on the flower or the potential. The breeder, Carl, will know if something maybe has potential. And
Carl,
then
Carl, what is his surname? I can't
Bennett,
remember.
Carl
He's
Bennett.
Brilliant,
He's
brilliant.
He's amazing. Mm. He has the best memory for roses and our rose breeding. He can go back generations of what was that bred with, and he'll go, well, okay, what was that bred? And he can go back a long way. He's got like a photographic memory. Mm. But that means he can feel what's going on with that rose.
And then they go out in the field. Because when you said it takes 4 years, but I mean, when I plant a rose that I buy from you, you're talking 4 years from seed, are you? But when I get a rose from you and I put it in the garden, I think it's establishing for 2 years. So I water it well and look after it well for 2 years, because it does take a bit longer. But they will look good in their first year, and then very good in their second year.
That is correct, particularly if you've got good soil.
Or you've got rubber soil.
But we do flower counts.
Yes.
We do flower counts during a trial period, and the amount of flower in the third year compared to the second year is like double. So you're getting twice as much flower by the third year. So that's really three stroke 4 years.
Really?
I planted an Olivia in this garden, is my rose garden here, and it second year it's mature. So some of them will get to maturity very quickly. Others will take a little bit longer.
So I mean, James Austin, for instance, that reaches maturity very fast, I find.
It's one of
my favourite rose.
It's
I love
one
it.
Of our best, definitely. Yeah. But not in all
rose.
Gardens, though. I would say, you know, I mean, I'm looking at as a perfectionist. I'm looking at it. When's it going to be at its very best? Mm. And you'll be happy in year two, without question.
Very happy, I am.
By year three, you'll be even happier.
Oh, good. Right. Okay. Lovely. It's interesting, isn't it, that they're so trendy and they've remained so trendy for so long. And I think it is because they are so versatile, aren't they? You can use them in the wild garden. You've got them in gravel here. I've never seen them growing in gravel before. You can have them in the formal rose beds. I think the way they used to grow them in the sort of 20s and 30s on their own is a bit passé now. Not many people do that. They like to mix and match them a bit more. But what are the most extreme or most unusual ways you've seen roses grown that you think that people might not think of? Because I'm looking at here, looking at them covering your arbors, your arches, your walkways. You've got hedges of
yeah,
roses.
Yeah, we've got them everywhere. Yeah,
you've got them up trees. I mean, you've just got them up walls. Is there anywhere I don't know of?
I think you've got most of the possibilities there. But the one thing I always try and almost promote is the wrong word, but I'm passionate about is standard roses.
Mm.
I think they're very underutilized, and we unfortunately they're very hard to produce commercially.
So just in case someone doesn't know what a standard rose is, so a standard is a bit like a broomstick with the rose on the top, and you have a clean stem and then the thing on the top, and they can either be half standard where they'll be on a stem of about 60 centimeters high, would you say?
Yeah.
Or a full standard when they're more like a meter and then you have the top.
That's it. That's correct.
Yes. So sorry, carry on.
They're
like mini trees.
Mini trees, and I think architecturally they give you something completely different
structure.
Yeah, more structure. Yeah, exactly. And two that I'd pick out, Harlow Carr for the massive flower. It's absolutely
pink.
Incredible.
Lovely pink.
Brilliant, fragrant, all the rest. But as I say, the problem is producing them. Very difficult. So we actually sell out every year. If we can crack growing them, and we are trying on our nursery. We used to grow them in East Anglia. We're now growing them on our nursery because they require so much attention. If we can crack that, we will be promoting them more. They're not cheap, but they're worth it for what they bring to the garden. Something you can have just one in a prime place, and you know, and it's partly inspired by a visit I did to Germany many, many years ago, where I saw I'm pretty sure it was an iceberg standard that literally it must have been 5 meters across, covered in flower, like a tree trunk. The trunk was probably 6 inches across,
150 diameter. Right,
it's unbelievable. So I'm not expecting
and
everyone
how old to, was that do you think
it was I'm gonna say 20 25 years old, might have been older. But you just go, this is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen, you know, just incredible.
What I find slightly difficult with standards, excuse my ignorance, but obviously you graft them at the ground point, and then you have this sort of broomstick which you put in, which, and the variety they choose for that broomstick bit is the bit that seems to produce different results, isn't it? That's getting that wood right is and then you graft it at the top again.
Exactly.
So it's got two graft points.
Yeah.
And so you need to watch for suckers at both points. And
it
can be quite difficult to see. Do you find this, or is it just me? You can do it easily. The suckers at the top?
Yeah, it's very, for me, it's very easy. I mean, literally,
I've just
missed one on a standard I've got in front of the house that was, that the sucker was nearly 5 foot tall. It had grown straight as a die through the centre of the shrub.
Oh, from the bottom?
From the middle. So it just looked like it had coming underneath the main plant head of the plant. No, they're usually along the, they're not usually right at the top.
Ah.
They're usually lower down. It's
so
very
that's
rare.
Why I'm not sure, because then I'm not having any at the top. I see all the ones coming up. They're easy to,
yes,
they're easy, as you say, because they're,
yes,
so upright, so vertical.
Yes. Yeah.
But the ones from the head, I thought that they also had a potential to sucker from the top. But, and I've never seen any,
you
which
know,
is why I thought I might have missed them.
No, exactly. I'm just thinking, I never even thought about this before, but I have never cut a sucker from the top graft.
Right.
So where the graft, there's three shrub, there's three shrubs basically on the top of a standard stem.
Three.
Yeah. And
no,
I remember,
wonder they're so expensive.
Exactly. So you've got a rootstock, you've got another graft, and then you've got three more grafts.
Yeah.
And I can remember going to our grower at the time saying, when the three goes to two, that's a shame. Why don't you bud four so that we've got three at least?
In case one dies.
And next year he budded the whole of his crop with four. It was a throwaway comment and it was a bit excessive.
So, yes.
But yeah.
Interesting. Now, I love standard roses. I did do a Gertrude Jekyll. I got some of those at standard, but they are, that you need a fairly robust rose. And much as the colour of Gertrude Jekyll, that wonderful dark purple, is to die for, she
No,
has a
she's
few
not
problems.
Not a
yeah,
great.
Sadly,
if I was to mention another one of my favourite, it would be Young Lycidas,
yes,
which is a purple, beautiful flower. And what you find is that Young Lycidas as a shrub is slightly more disease prone. Standards, because they're high,
more air,
much more airflow, much more resistant.
Wow, I hadn't thought of
that.
Yeah,
incredible. Whatever's good as a shrub will be even better as a standard in terms of performance and disease resistance.
I remember someone did Rambling Rector as a standard. Now, Rambling Rector, for those that don't know, is a sort of rambler that if you put it at the bottom of a 100-foot tree, it'll reach the top and the wood beyond. You know, it goes mad. But if you keep that as a standard, you will be cutting it probably every week of your life because it's so vigorous and it just wants to go.
It'd be
so
fascinating.
That would be mad.
Well,
there
is weeping standards,
yes,
and there are certain, they are basically less vigorous ramblers than Rambling Rector. I love a challenge. I wouldn't mind having a go at that. Just see what happens.
And when you do weeping standards, do you put those sort of upturned hanging baskets on?
Well,
the
you
top
can
to
you,
train them. Round,
well, I
don't
think
you bother?
I don't. I've never actually. I've never really seen a really good one, if I'm honest. But I would love to try one and see.
Fascinating. So your garden here is beautiful. So you've got this lovely former rectory, grade two listed, and you moved here with your partner, Penny, 15 years ago.
We did.
You've done amazing things to it.
We have.
How derelict was it before?
The previous owner, Judge Bruce Morgan, was here for 25 years, and no disrespect, you might need to take his name out of this. No disrespect, the garden before had been left for 25 years.
He was a wildlife gardener.
There's a famous story where we're on a road, we've got a beautiful old wall, dewstone wall, and a verge that was covered in brambles. And the local farmer decided to do Bruce a favour and mow it. He went absolutely mad. He's wild gardener. You've just ruined the habitat for all the insects or whatever. So he had a theory, but I understand why people want a wild garden to some extent. But it's also an excuse not to garden. So if you don't want to be a gardener, have a wild garden, and the garden will take over. There was an orchard at the front here. I mean, and a greenhouse hidden under the trees. I mean, totally, totally overgrown. Mm. But fortunately, the previous owners at some stage must have been great gardeners. There's some amazing trees. Favourite being handkerchief tree, which is incredible.
And it flowers.
And it flowers. Ooh, it's unbelievable. And some great other trees as well.
No, it's interesting, this business of wild gardening, because obviously it's gathered a lot of momentum because of the planet and things. And I remember going around Miriam Rothschild's garden with her shortly before she died, And, you know, you had sort of creepers coming in the window and things like that. And it was verging on the Miss Havisham type feel. But she loved it. And that's what her whole thing was, isn't it? So, and what I love about gardening is you do it the way you want it.
Totally.
And I don't think people can criticise you. You know, you're living in it. You're not doing it for the neighbours.
No, exactly.
So yeah. As long as you're not spreading. But as we were coming along, and I haven't been to this house before, I've always seen you at the nursery, I thought that has... can only be David's garden, because I saw, you know, the roses everywhere and things like that. Most people must joke about that, don't they? You don't need to put signs or what your house is called.
It's well, you would so be amazed. Obvious. We're called the Old Rectory. We're next to a church. How many people drive by and miss the house next to the church and go to the shop up the road and say, "Where's the Old Rectory?" You know, this is delivery drivers, you know.
Oh, delivery drivers wouldn't know. I was going to say, but friends would know. The Amazon driver might not have clocked who you are.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
How funny. And your soil, would it be good, right?
It's excellent.
Tell me what it is.
It's slightly acidic and it's heavy. It's heavy soil, clayish soil, so which is perfect for roses. So roses do really well here. But it's quite varied in places, though. So some patches are a little bit poorer than others. But it's a good rose garden.
Yeah, it's totally opposite to mine, which is we're drier than you because we're on the east. We've got very thin limestone brush. They like it a slightly acid, don't they?
Yes.
But I have to say, having said that... a lot of your roses do really well. I do bang on the mulch relentlessly. And windflower.
Yeah.
Now, was that late David's favourite rose? It's a beautiful sort of... That's what Michael Marrett used to say. That was his favourite. But you disagree. But I love that because it does look like an anemone. And it is a very naturalistic looking rose. But and a lovely shrubby rose. But at the same time, it repeats well. And it goes bananas with me. It's just so beautiful.
That's really good.
So repeat.
Now, my father didn't have a favourite rose. Genuinely didn't. And the reason for that, he was all about the next rose. So he wanted the next rose to be his favourite. You know, he didn't want to think that he'd all completed his work in any way. And although it's not completing your work to say you got a favourite, but it also almost implies that there's... he didn't want to accept that as being the best. He wanted, he was always
go on
with his work.
Right. So, and which is yours? Can I ask?
Same thing. Favourite. Yeah. Not necessarily for the same reasons, but I think a rose, what we're looking at is a collection of roses, all of which are amazing. When you put them in the right place, that's Malvern Hills that we can see there
on the arch,
and
so
the
it's
old
a white repeat flowering, very naturalistic.
No, that's all,
oh, the yellowy
which
one
is going over a little bit, but that is a phenomenal rambler. It's amazing, and every year you think, oh, it's not going to do very well this year. It looks a little bit sparse, and then 3 weeks later, it's just covered in flower. It's incredible.
So ramblers, traditionally, many of them were not repeat flowering.
Correct.
And then you've bred into them the repeat flowering thing.
Yeah.
So they're more dainty than climbers, would you say? Or more, they seem to be generally more looser.
Exactly.
Naturalistic.
Yeah. What is a rambler and what is a climber? Yeah.
But now you've made the repeat flowering, it is very difficult
it's
to
very
say.
Obvious.
And would you say it is?
Well, it's
the way
I think
you prune
it,
them?
It's if you look at all the ramblers that we all know, like you've mentioned, Rambling Rector, they have a very loose, strong growth. It's thin. They flower on the old wood as well, and they tend to be much smaller flowers, you know. So a climber, I think, of one of ours being a large flowered variety that will get to maybe 10 feet unless it's on a wall when it can go taller, whereas a rambler would go 20, 25, 30 feet if you let it go. So they're much more vigorous.
Yeah.
And I'm sure genetically, as somebody would explain, there's some massive genetic difference.
Yeah.
They are bred from a completely different line. So these will have been bred with existing ramblers. So there's a definite genetic difference.
Right, no, that's interesting. And pruning is different, isn't it? So you, with something like Malvern Hills, which you've got over that archway, to prune that, you won't prune it like a climber and just cut the side shoots off after it's flowered?
Well, what you're looking for always is that long, strong new growth that you'll bend over, and that's where the next year's flowers will shoot from. But also, the older wood, you will cut back the flowering stem, and you will get flowering off that as well. It's not that different, really.
Not really, just
in terms of the you're dealing with such a different plant. You can't kind of compare the two. But when you actually think logically about what you're doing, it's not hugely different.
Mm. Right. Okay. If you lived in anywhere in this country that had really extreme conditions, is there any sort of conditions that you wouldn't try growing any rose? Or do you think you could just about grow any rose anywhere in the UK?
You can't grow any rose anywhere.
Is there always a rose?
I mean, traditionally, we talk about rugosa roses being the hardiest. But I think there are certain of our roses are so strong, so vigorous. I will be planting some roses on the west coast of Ireland shortly, and I'm really interested to see which ones survive that salty water. But where this garden is, there are rugosas are there already doing really well. So,
yeah.
But I'd like to go beyond rugosas and see whether, we do recommend roses for seaside areas. Roses.
Spinosissima is the sort of traditional one.
That's another one. But I think it's much wider than that. I think people look at them and think, oh, they're tough, and they do look tough, and they are tough. But I think certain of our varieties are also really strong and really tough. And I'm
Mayflower.
Sure that
do you think Mayflower would do?
Yeah, good shout. That could do well. But I'd like to see something like an Olivia, see how that does, because it is very, very vigorous and healthy. I can't see why that shouldn't do fine in those conditions as well.
You've mentioned Olivia several times now, so it's named after your daughter.
Yeah, and it was kind of a breakthrough rose for us, where we could see that the disease resistant was on another level. And it's also an amazing repeat flower, so it's flowers the first and then it'll repeat, so it's one that will repeat three or four times easily in a year in the right position and the right conditions. It's just phenomenal. Mm. Phenomenal. And this year we replanted, and the color I got out of my Olivia was off the scale. It was so vivid and strong. Sometimes it can be a bit pale, but it shows that if you really get them growing really well, you can get this kind of amazing results from them.
So the colour changes.
Yeah,
with
absolutely.
The soil conditions.
I knew when you bring
them into Chelsea, they're different, because they've been grown under glass for Chelsea, and they don't look as strong a colour, I always think, as when they're outside.
Well, I'm glad you say that, because I think sometimes the Chelsea roses seem a little bit too big. The flowers
the flowers are too big.
And yeah, I think the colours are quite vibrant. I think they're about the same, personally.
Oh, you think so?
I don't
okay.
think it's that
yeah, I'm sure you're right.
Yeah, it's the size of the flower. So you they just look a little bit too big, you know, which is not the end of the world for a show, but
and the light's so different inside than outside, isn't it? Under that pavilion. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And that you will always do, hopefully, because you're a main sort of go-to thing, and that's really helped put you on the map.
Oh, absolutely,
yeah.
I mean, it's brought us to a worldwide audience is the number one thing, I think.
Yeah.
And it's a great opportunity to connect with our loyal customers. You know, you've got the keenest gardeners go to Chelsea, and we're there every year, and, you know, we're always grateful that people still love what we do and they come to our stand in their droves. So long may that continue.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're talking to someone who wants to get into roses, well, what is your best tip, actually? Let's say, what's your best tip for growing roses that people might not realise? I mean, they do like a good soil, don't they? And everyone knows that. But even on my poor soil, if you put on the mulch and everything, they will go well.
Yeah.
I don't actually feed mine. I don't believe in artificial fertilizers. I just do it all through the soil. So I had the mulch. All the new research seems to say that, but I bet.
Well,
you
no,
would
I think. Well, not, no, don't. I grew on a sandy soil in my previous But one garden, oh my goodness, that is a challenge. You need to know what you're doing. And I would say that...
Because of the lack of water retention.
Lack of water and how all the nutrition will go through. Yes, yeah. If you can get farmyard manure and you can really build up the soil, great. But I would say in those conditions, feed as well, because you need to give that rose every chance you can. So, attack it in as many different ways as you can, but... It is all about the soil, but and it's a bit of a this is a bit of a cliche, but it's so true. Pick the right rose.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just don't just ask if you're going somewhere. If you come to our place, and you're new to gardening or anywhere you go, find somebody who knows what they're talking about and get them to recommend a rose for you, because they will make sure you get a rose you've got every chance of succeeding with. And if I'm honest, you know. There are probably about 200 fantastic roses. That's all. The rest, you've got to be a good gardener to get fantastic performance. Not that they all can't look great, but if you've never done it before, go for one of those 200 best roses.
Right, okay, so you give me 3 or 4 of your best, and I'll give you 3 or 4 of mine, and we'll see if we agree. this is for then, and I'm talking about my very less than perfect soil, but they do really well for me.
Okay. I've mentioned Olivia many, many times.
Yeah.
That is an amazing rose.
Can we have a white rose as well in your list? Because a lot of people love a good white rose, and they seem to be difficult.
Yeah. Our best white rose at the moment is Claire Austin, but it's a big grower. Yeah. So it, you know, probably, I think we only sell it as a climber. You can grow it as a shrub if you know what you're doing, but that is a very reliable rose. And it's, in terms of Ramblers, I would definitely go with Malvern Hills, because it's just an incredible performer.
Right, okay. Yeah, so I would put James Austin on that list. You wouldn't put that? Because for me, James does really well.
James Austin is a fantastic rose, yeah. Mm. I mean, I could go on with a number that I think are in that category. So James Austin, 100%.
A lovely deep red colour, which I really like.
Yeah.
Sort of almost claret, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I would put Windflower, which I mentioned before, because I think that's a stonking rose. But you don't find that? For me, it does. And it looks just
Windflower.
Like it's just with an anemone, you see. I love that. Yeah. Very delicate, in a woodlandy setting.
Now, my memory of Windflower is not as good as... you need to send me a photo of that to rekindle my interest in it, because it's a forgotten rose for me.
Well, I've got about 10 of them, and I've taken some from cuttings, and they do... They were growing under hazel trees.
Okay. I would say if Windflower went into our trials now, it wouldn't get through.
Really?
I would say that, honestly.
Really? On disease things?
Just vigour, lack of vigour.
Oh, my God.
But you see, you're a professional gardener. You're a gardener. You know what you're doing. You know what you're doing with your soil. I would not, without re-seeing it and retrialing, I wouldn't recommend that rose.
Isn't that interesting? Now, why is that?
Now, there's another rose, it's kind of similar, called Lark Ascending, right?
Yes, which is much better known.
It's like an apricot, loose, single-ish flower. That is a remarkable rose. It's an amazing shrub and an amazing performer. So I would, I mean, in terms of its shrub shape and its performance, it would be 5 times better than Windflower.
And as big as
but
Windflower.
I can't... Windflower's
big. It's as big as me.
And how wide?
It probably is a metre, 1.5 wide.
You've done well with that. Obviously, maybe it likes the lime. Maybe it likes limes,
maybe
lime soil.
Yeah.
We're, at the nursery, we're slightly acidic.
And it's never fed. I never feed them, apart from mulch.
Yeah, and this... I mean, where this is interesting is... Roses will perform differently in different soils, in different areas,
plant,
you know.
That's so confusing with horticulture. You see something in some garden, it looks amazing. In another garden, it looks rubbish.
Yeah.
And the other one I would put, which isn't one of yours, though, is Mutabilis, which I just love. Or the China roses, because they're all a bit tender, but that grows under cork oaks. It seems to grow anyway. And Emma Bridgewater, your lovely new one, reminds me of that.
Mm-hmm.
With the shading, the change of colour from the apricot pink.
Yeah, purple. It's like you say that Mutabilis is one of the classics. I've grown it myself, but it is, as you say, a little bit tender. So again, it's not for everybody, in my opinion. Yeah, it's tender. So and
all
you know,
the China roses are slightly tender.
Slightly tender, and diseases are definitely tougher than they were. Rust is definitely much. I mean, when I started, rust. We never talked about rust 30 years ago. Rust is the biggest problem for roses now.
Yeah. So this thing of growing salvias, you know, do you think that's rubbish? Some people say because salvias give off sulfur, if you grow them amongst your roses, it will stop the black spot, which is fungal. But when I've spoken to other rose owners about this, they say BS. BS. Not
it
right.
Sounds
what's your view on this?
Too good to be true.
Have you tried it though?
No, but we will. We'll have a go. We'll do a proper trial.
Proper trial.
And see.
Yeah.
See. I mean, is there a particular salvia you need to grow? Is there?
I would just check on something like which give off the most sulfur. Is it?
Okay.
That do it? So you would check the aromaticness of the leaves, I suppose. But
yeah. It could be interesting, couldn't it? Every rose surrounded by salvia.
They do go quite well together, though, don't they? Something
lovely. I love mixing herbaceous with roses.
Which just goes on and on forever. It's so easy. Yeah. But back to Emma Bridgewater, I have to say, people are always banging on about scenting roses for obvious reasons. But to my mind, that is the highest scented rose I've ever smelt.
Really?
Would you agree with that? Or is it again, it's individual, isn't it?
We've got a rose called Nye Bevan, which we nearly didn't introduce because I didn't think it had got enough fragrance. And I'd looked at this rose 30 times over 4 years, and I thought, no. Then all of a sudden, two or three people came out and looked at it and went, I can smell it. And took it inside. And also, when you cut it, sometimes it releases scent as well. That's an interesting point. You smell it straight away, doesn't it? You take it inside and it warms up and it releases its scent.
A scent is temperature dependent.
Yeah. Scent is, you can have almost like color blindness. You can have scent blindness, I think. So certain scents, certain people can't pick up.
Yeah.
Emma Bridgewater, again, through the same process, I've never marked it as very strong. I've had it as medium scent at our nursery. Okay. But, you know, it's got a good scent, but I'm so pleased to hear that you're getting that much scent from it, because that's amazing.
Yes.
Again, that's back to variability, you know. But the Emma Bridgewater is really interesting because the kind of thinking is, and our experience on the whole has been, pure colours are the most popular. So pure white is always one, you know.
The white garden syndrome and all that,
could be,
isn't it?
But like a yellow, I mean, if you get the right tone of yellow, yellow is one of my favourite colours, and it's often looked down upon.
Denigrated.
And I hate it. It really annoys me because it's a beautiful colour. You get the right, I can just see a pilgrim over the top of the wall here. It's amazing colour, but it's quite pure.
Haslam would not like that. Too common.
Emma Bridgewater is multicoloured, but it seems to be in a way that is attractive. So I was a little bit nervous about, I loved it as a plant, and you know, its performance is fantastic. I wondered whether it would be as, it's proved to be more popular than I expected, which is lovely.
It's a winner. I really, really love it. And what about, with scent though, I always remember your father saying to me, so Princess Diana came up to him at Chelsea and she was going into, I can't say the word, but she was really amazed by the scent of your roses. And he said afterwards, do you know, I think she must be pregnant. He was right. But they do say when you're pregnant, you do smell much more, don't you? And at different times of life.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Yeah. But scent varies enormously. But it's such an essential part of a rose. I mean, we do introduce the odd rose if it's outstanding in every other way. And the two examples are Kew Gardens and Tottering by Gently. They are phenomenal roses. They're incredible.
And Kew Gardens, you've got your hedge running down your drive. And it's a white repeat flowering, and it grows to about a metre,
a little bit more if you have a plant on its own, it might get to 5 feet whatever that is in metres, Benny.
1.2 or something. And you'll cut that with hedge cutters.
You can do, but
I'm... you don't. You prune.
No, we prune them properly. And we had a little thing recently at the nursery where somebody said there was a flower. We do a trial on all our roses again. We retrial them. We count the number of flowers. And somebody said, this rose has got 500 flowers on it. And somebody went, no, that's ridiculous. They went out, Kew Gardens, 500 flowers. All right, they're small, but what's that? Bigger than a 50 pence piece, you know, decent size, 500 flowers. Wow. That's not bad, is it?
And for how many months of that of the year do you reckon you'll have flowers on that rose?
It's already sending its next, it's well on its way to sending its next flowering. So it'll have flowers on it right the way through.
So
right
they'll
the way
start
through.
In late May.
Yeah.
And they'll go on till December.
Yeah. First frost is the thing. When the frosts come, that finishes off a lot of roses.
That's pretty good. That's your most floriferous, you reckon?
Yeah, and it's just, and they're beautiful. That's the point. Yeah. It's not the quantity.
And
but
they're
it's
white.
Start a little. Yeah, and another thing, designers. I mean, we've got a great guy working with us now, very close to the designers, and he says they all want a pure white. And I go, what? What's wrong with that rose? It's got a little bit of yellow when it starts off. And what's up with these designers? Look at the whole thing, for goodness sake, you know. it's a phenomenal rose, and you're bothered about a little bit of yellow because your design isn't perfect. Come on.
Vita Sackville West had tinges of pink in her roses in her white garden, didn't she?
Did she?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Okay, so that's really fascinating. Now, I always bring my guests a wee present, and I brought you a rooted cutting of plumbago.
Fantastic.
Auriculata, known as leadwort. Now, this is a fascinating plant, I think, because if you look at all the books, they'll say a greenhouse plant. But it does survive. It has survived in my garden outside in winters.
Fantastic.
But if you want, and in London, it goes on with its leaves evergreen all through
really?
The winter.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
But in your garden here, you'll be colder, so maybe not. So maybe pop it into your lovely greenhouse.
Oh.
But it will grow to well over a metre high, and it will scramble up. I often grow it on wigwams. Very quick from cuttings.
So I put it in a big pot, maybe.
Yeah,
and bring it out in the summer.
Grow it up somewhere, and then we'll have these most beautiful blue flowers that go on and on, often to Christmas with me.
Great.
So I think it's a stonking great plant. And when I put it on a YouTube video, people from really cold areas, much colder than Britain, said, "Oh God, ours are hardy outside." I think in horticulture, particularly now with social media and YouTubes and things, you learn that plants do many different things that you often thought they didn't, because you have contact with people all over the globe. So it is fascinating, but it's been really lovely to see this garden. I am bowled over by it, and you work in it. You do the veg garden, which is immaculate. You're going to expand it. How you have time for it, I don't know. So you are a businessman, I reckon. You're a plantsman, you're a rose grower and a gardener.
And I'm a golfer. And I'm
I didn't know that.
I've 2 days a week I golf.
Your handicap thing?
18.
Well, that's not good.
It's not good, but it's getting better.
My dad used to be 7, but I didn't think he was very good. Maybe I've got it wrong.
And I also have a passion for classic cars, which I spend a lot of time stripping engines and stuff. So I'm
I did notice that old Fergie by your front door.
Yes.
But you don't do those as well.
I'm not into tractors, no. Not yet. I haven't got time.
So a jack of all trades, but master of several.
Hopefully. Hopefully.
Anyway, it's been lovely. Thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure.